This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. In 1914, a black farmer named Benjamin Carr is quoted saying, "The farmer is the only free man we have in our race." The quote is one of the historical inspirations that drove scholar Monica White to write about the role of farm cooperatives in the black freedom struggle. The book, Freedom Farmers, flips the script on black agriculture from a story rooted only in slavery and oppression to one that details acts of resilience and resistance for black Americans. Monica White is an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Her research focuses on sustainable community food systems with marginalized communities. Monica, welcome to The State of Things.
Thank you so much for having me.
Talk about why you chose to write this book and what inspired it.
Yes, I had an opportunity to move back to Detroit to take care of my parents and needed a research topic as I was teaching at Research One Institution, and really wanted to capture the voices of African Americans that were returning to our agricultural roots to provide nutrient-rich food sources for folks in Detroit during the economic downturn of the automobile restructure. And so wanting to be involved in the food justice movement, but also wanting to understand the precursors to this current movement, I felt it necessary to really sort of not just talk about what was happening in terms of urban ag today, but what are the trajectories and how can we complicate the story of folks who use food as a strategy of freedom.
Well, I want to take you back to that and those historical roots, but again, talk more about farming in Detroit, because that strikes the ear as not quite right. So talk about the resilience and the rise of that. Yeah, tell us more.
Sure. So we saw that there was in a city that was built to provide resources for almost 2 million. The economic downturn meant that there were fewer than about 655,000 folks after the restructuring of the automobile industry and populations left. Even before then, there was a history of agriculture in Detroit. I would even argue that wherever there have been people, people have grown food in cities. And it is it seems like it's a new idea, but it really isn't a new idea. Folks have always grown food in cities. And Detroit, given the fact that it spread out instead of grew up, meant that the economic downturn created access to available land, and people didn't have access to resources with regard to grocery stores and what have you, and started taking matters into their own hands and utilizing these vacant lots to produce food, but also not just food for themselves, but food for community. And so you would see community growing spaces that would capture or would have music, it would have beautiful artwork, they would have programs and cooking classes and how to provide nutrient-rich food sources for folks in the community. And so as you drive through Detroit, what used to be abandoned house lots, now you see vibrant with food production and the kinds of conversations that take place in a space using food as its core.
And as you say, this is a response to the 2008 downturn, but as you said, this is not anything new. Tell us about the three wise men and a sister.
So I talk about the work of George Washington Carver, Booker T. Washington, and Du Bois as the three wise men. And about 100 years ago, they told us the role and importance of agriculture for building black communities. And I say that they're the three wise men, and the sister who showed them how to do it is Fannie Lou Hamer. And her work really sort of, in addition to looking at models and what food allows us to do, Mrs. Hamer created Freedom Farm Agricultural Cooperative, about 680 acres. They had a mobile food market. They had commercial kitchens. They had a community growing space. They provided all kinds of educational retraining programs for folks who were fired from their jobs for registering to vote. And so what you see happening is that as the agricultural industry was sort of really changing, black labor was no longer needed. And so in addition to that, our voting meant we would not only be fired from our jobs, but evicted from the places that we worked, usually on the land that was owned by the person who, the landowner.
Right.
And so the complicated part of that is to sort of see how people were taking control of and demonstrating their own agency and resilience by pulling their resources together and establishing cooperatives and collectives.
And this is a complicated story because two of those wise men, you talk about George Washington Carver and Booker T. Washington, are seen as sort of very conservative in this movement. Some call them accommodationist back then, and that was not a kind word often in the mouths of those who used it. But you're saying, now, this is a much more radical concept than it appears to be, and certainly today.
Oh, yes, I would agree. I think that to dismiss Booker T. Washington's ideas as only being accommodationist is to really miss the nuance of who he was and what he was able to do. I would argue that he, and I need to really go out and sort of prove this, but I think that he gave different messages for different audiences. And really what he did in terms of, you know, creating this model of Tuskegee University that still exists, the students knew how to do everything. They knew how to make shoes. They built bricks. They built the school. They grew the food. And all the things that were necessary for survival really took place there at Tuskegee. And so I think that overlooking all that he did for farmers is really to miss an opportunity to examine the role and the importance and often the significance of food production.
Well, the other way this gets complicated is because, and as we said, in the introduction, you're flipping the script here because there is an association of farming and agricultural life with slavery and the oppression of rural life, particularly in the South. And who wouldn't want to get away from that? Mm-hmm. So tell us more about how this flips the script and reclaims farming as a source of freedom and resistance.
Sure. So I think that when you think of Black agriculture or Black farmers, we often talk and think about slavery, tenant farming, and sharecropping. But I think that to talk to and to listen to folks like your opening quote or Reverend Paris, who says, you can free yourself when you can feed yourself, within that becomes this narrative of how do we, using the earth as a, you know, as an ally, use the earth to grow food. What does food allow us to do? It allows us to provide for ourselves, but also provide for community. And then, even today in Detroit, Baba Malik Yakini talks about food as a strategy. But if we can control our food source, can we also think about community education? Can we also think about other ways that we can make some claims in terms of what we should have access to, and also demonstrate our own agency and resilience by showing what that looks like? So I think that these food conversations have always been not just about providing for ourselves, but providing collectively. And then once we are able to feed ourselves, then what are the other kinds of things that we're able to do?
I'm talking to Monica White from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Her book is Freedom Farmers. It's available now. She's going to be speaking at the Center for Environmental Farming Systems Farm to Fork Annual Sustainable Agriculture Lecture. That's Thursday in Chapel Hill. The event is ticketed. We have information at our website, stateofthings.org. And again, you talked about communities being together. You've said that several times. You looked at the role of cooperatives throughout the history of farming and, of course, American history. And Black cooperatives, many of the ones that you profile in your book, were actually formed in response to very specific kinds of discrimination. So give us some examples.
Sure. So as I mentioned earlier, we definitely see this disconnect between what happens when folks speak out for, you know, or even register to vote, right? You're fired and you're evicted. And so it is within this backdrop that there had already been some organizing around civil rights conversations, but also the need for a voice to speak about the lack of access to nutrient-rich food. And so knowing that folks were growing various, like tobacco or cotton or soybeans, and these were cash crops, but if we can grow those kinds of crops, can we also grow the kinds of food crops that can be used for our communities, but also use that in terms of shared various food hubs and other kinds of strategies that they were able to engage and to enact, especially during the late 1960s. And I think, even in the book, sort of mapping out how much folks were, you know, working toward improved food systems, I think is something that is often overlooked.
Yeah, and those systems included the inputs. So when when white retailers and wholesalers refused to sell oil to Black farmers who registered to vote, many of those Black farmers formed a cooperative and then provided their own. So it wasn't only agriculture, it was all of
the inputs, right? That's right.
Well,
and I think it's also, I'm sorry.
No, please do. I want you to complete that.
I think it's also important to sort of recognize that it was that they recognized individually there was a vulnerability, right? Dara Cooper talks about that sort of vulnerability of land ownership as an individual versus the collective power. And so throughout history, we see food as a strategy of resistance and resilience, especially for Black, for the African-American community. But we also can think about the ways that pulling our resources together to buy seeds, to share labor, labor to share tools and instruments. Every farmer doesn't need a tractor. If we have a nicer tractor that more of us can sort of share and access, there's where our power is. But it's not just in the growth. It also teaches us something about politics, teaches us something about economics, and it teaches something about the social climate and what we need to do in order to improve our living conditions, especially in rural areas, but I would also argue in urban areas.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's something marvelously subversive about the entire model, because when you're talking about cooperatives again and flipping the script, you're talking about people who are growing food for nutrition, which is historically what humans have done, not commodities, which is historically what capitalism does. So you're flipping that script. We grow this food to eat, not as a commodity. We own the land, not as a form of dominance, right? Playing monopoly to get the monopoly so that we can then force other people. We're actually cooperating here and we're sharing the land, and there are going to be fights. There are going to be arguments. So it is interesting in the many ways that cooperatives, land cooperatives and farm cooperatives do turn the story on its head.
Oh, beautifully said. I like how you put that.
Okay, you can use that. Take that anytime. Tell me, but right now, what are some of the structural barriers to access for good food in those communities that have not had access?
I think, you know, people often use a frame, food desert. And I was speaking with your producer as to why that is a distasteful phrase. And part of the reason is because we produce enough food to eat, for everyone to be fed. But the ways that we distribute it, the ways we process it, the ways we get rid of a third of the food we produce is wasted even before it reaches anyone's table. The ways that we distribute food, the system, the supply chain is fractured. And even in Detroit, we call Detroit food insecure, but there's a lot of food that is shipped into Detroit and goes out through the Eastern market, the wholesale area. So we needed a different way to sort of talk about the disconnect between retailers, distributors, and what have you. And I think that what the food justice movement is asking for, or demanding, shall I say, is that there be a real reconsideration of how a regenerative model instead of an extractive model. So how can we be in control of food production, food distribution, food preparation, and make sure that we know where the seeds come from and how that food is grown, making sure that it's nutritious for not just myself, but my community. And then also, how can we then build other kinds of entities and establishments to support that food system, which also supports that community development. So we're talking about healthy whole communities and not just the individual or a family.
Given the fact that I would only push back slightly, because you said that system is fractured and so it doesn't get there. It doesn't get there and it should. But one could argue that it is precisely designed to do just
that's
that.
That's right.
That it
that's
is precisely right. designed that's to right. do that. That's if right. that's true and that design is working so well for so few people, but it works very well and those are the people in control.
Right.
Are these alternate systems you're talking about, are they something that we do in tandem with the governing system right now, or does something have to be overthrown? Will there be too much resistance from the current way that we produce and consume and supply food to your model to actually survive in a sensible or sustainable way?
What I will say is that there are successes of the food justice movement. When you go into your grocery store, you can't go into the produce section and not see labeling of organic or sustainably grown, local foods, and that. I think that that is a marker of success for the food justice movement, broadly defined, right? And so I think that in addition to seeing it in grocery stores, I think that there are movements of folks that are creating alternate systems. So I do think that we have a requirement. I mean, at the moment, we go to grocery stores. We do, contribute to GDP in various kinds of ways, in terms of our supplies. But I also think that there's a growing sense that we need to be in control of the food that we consume and the benefits of that food. And so there are, at the same time, the structure of food preparation and food distribution in ways that are outside of government and even market, mass market basis.
What are some of the success stories that you've seen?
Wow. So I would say that Mr. Briquette, who is a third-generation farmer from Petal, Mississippi, talks about the importance of a cooperative. He's in Indian Springs, Mississippi. And so he talks about it. Had it not been for the cooperative, he's not sure he would have been able to keep the land in his family since the 1800s. And I hold that example very close to me, because I think that farmers, small family farmers, in this current moment, there is a crisis. There should be an alarm that goes off, that we really are doing things in in the wrong direction when the state of Wisconsin now rates highest in the farm foreclosure crisis and dairy farmers are closing. So if white farmers are getting it, then you know that black farmers, especially those in the South, are also suffering. And so I think that this is an important moment for us to hold dear small family farmers, many of whom have been working very hard, toiling to make sure we have access to food. In some cases, our food insecure themselves. And so I think that this is a current moment for us to all be asking questions, who grows our food and who benefits from the sale of it.
How much of this is based in public policy at the national and at the state level, and what policies could change to lower the barriers?
I absolutely think that a lot of the policies, particularly USDA, really privilege the larger farmers, the larger voices, and those who hold a lot of land mass, also recognizing that they're not the ones that are, for the most part, growing food. It's the small family farmer who grows a lot of our food. So I think that the policy position has to be very clarified to make sure that we provide resources to those who are struggling to hold on to the land and to grow food.
Monica White, an associate professor of environmental justice at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Her new book is called Freedom Farmers. It's available now. She's going to be speaking at the Center for Environmental Farm Systems. It's a farm-to-fork annual sustainable agriculture lecture. Thursday in Chapel Hill. It's a ticketed event, but we do have all the information at our website, stateofthings.org. Monica White, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
On the next Movies on the Radio, we want to know your favorite quotes from cinema. Which lines do you often use? Pepper every one of your conversation, little bits of dialogue, make my day. You know what I'm talking about, family friendly or not. They confuse everyone because nobody knows where it came from. Your favorite line from the movies. Submit your picks by email, sot@wnc.org, or tweet at us, #SOTMovie, for a chance to be on the show. The show is The State of Things, and it is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, Grant Hullab-Mormon, and Josie Taris. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.